اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat. We hope that, inshallah, tonight will be a night that all brothers and sisters are going to be able to benefit from, as the night is tonight is the second night of the series of three nights that we are supposed to be engaging in worship, in ibadah, in order to hopefully have the following year be a better year for us, from a spiritual perspective as well as a material one. We hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accepts all the efforts that the believers have put in commemorating the shahada of our beloved Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullah alayhi. What we've tried to do, as you all should know, over the course of these nights, is to put these two together. We want to learn from what happened at the time of our beloved Imam that led to his shahada, despite being the best leader, despite being the best and most competent, most knowledgeable in the field of leadership, from a worldly perspective even, and not only and simply from a spiritual perspective. Although he was that, but over the course of 4 years and 9 months, his circumstances reached a point where the support amongst the people was not there. People were not following instructions. People did not follow him for battle. Despite those, the numbers that did follow Muawiyah to go to battle with the Imam. But on the Imam side, you don't see that. We want to learn from that and benefit on these nights, so we can try to, on a personal level, on a family level, in our families, and also on a community level, as well as a global community level, try to improve ourselves. Make sure we move towards eradicating the problems in us as individuals, as families, in our progeny, in our children, and also in our communities, so that we don't see the same happening to us, inshallah. What we tried to discuss on the previous session was to cover what happened during the time of the second Khalifa, which is when we see some of the foundations laid down for the rest of the problems that were going to come about. We said that, and I'm going to very briefly recap. We said that this Khalifa, the very fact of him being the Khalifa, as opposed to the one that God had made the Khalifa, was itself a step in the wrong direction and very fundamentally wrong. And that itself was something we have to learn from that. All the problems that we see, and we're going to talk about some of them over the course of these nights, the root of all of them is the leadership of that community being handed to someone that's not qualified. Some of the things that we saw after that were the character of the second Khalifa, He was a very rigid man, someone that was very harsh against whoever disagreed with him, whoever didn't follow instructions. And that created a culture that allowed the Khalifa to do as they wish, and no one would have the guts to be able to object. No one would feel they have the right to do that. And we said that this type of character is very devastating in any type of leadership, including the leadership that a husband needs to have at home. This type of leadership is not acceptable. We talked about that a bit, and we got into the idea of the privileged in that community. During the time of the second Khalifa, there started to form a class of the privileged people, the affluent people. It started to form, and this was very devastating. Now, it became a lot worse during the time of the third Khalifa, but the foundation was put down at the time of the second Khalifa. How did this happen? During the battles that we touched on yesterday as well, one of the things that happened as a result of them was that a lot of wealth started coming in and pouring into the Muslim Empire. A lot of it. In different ways. For example, when the Muslims were able to conquer parts of Persia, Iraq being specifically mentioned as an example, if you study what Iraq has right now, especially the southern part of it, the northern parts were referred to as the Jazeera and other names were mentioned, but south of Baghdad, if you look at that predominantly, even today, it's a very, very wealthy part of the world from the perspective of natural resources. Especially in that part of the world. And they say in California, whatever you grow, whatever you plant and you try to cultivate, it's going to grow. Iraq has very fertile lands that you can pretty much grow anything in the southern regions. Now, when the Muslimin took that over, what happened to those lands? Who did those lands belong to? We have something called Al-Aradi al-Maftuh an Watan, or Al-Aradi al-Maftuha an Watan, which means the lands that have been conquered by force. There are those lands that were conquered, whether during the time of the Prophet or afterwards, by force, and there were those that the people would leave them to the believers without battle. The land of Fadak, for example, is considered one of those that is taken without battle. Then you have lands that are taken through a battle. There's fighting going on to gain those lands. When you have a land that's taken without battle, they refer to that as Anfal or Fay'. Then you have those other lands that are taken by force. The ones that are not taken by force are going to be controlled by the political leader of the Muslim Ummah, the Holy Prophet at his time, and after him it should have been Amirul Mu'mineen. Since Amirul Mu'mineen was put aside, then naturally that control went to who? It went to the Khalifa. You have the lands of Iraq, they are considered al-Aradi al-Maftuha an Watan. They are the ones that are taken by force. What happens to them? What happens is that those lands belong to believers and Muslimin from that point onwards. When they're taken, they belong to all believers. They don't belong to a specific person. They don't even belong to the Khalifa or the Imam specifically. It belongs to all believers. So what happens is those lands are given to people to work on, but everybody's got to take a certain portion for themselves. The rest of it, a good portion, goes for the believers that needs to be distributed. large amounts of wealth, millions and millions. The second year, I believe, I remember if I recall correctly, the second year of the Muslims' conquer of that region, there was 120 million dirhams that came out of that land. And this is before it progresses to even further than that. This is the second year after the land has been conquered by the believers. The khiraj of it, the taxes that came, that were supposed to be distributed amongst the believers, they came out to be 120 million dirhams, silver coins. That's only from that region. When the believers went to Egypt, the Egyptians fought hard, as many of the people and many of the Christians in Sham as well. This is something we see in Sham as well. Something that a lot of us don't know, in the conquest that happened, the Christians that were being fought against in regions, many regions of Sham and in Egypt and in other places, they fought hard and they didn't give in. What they ended up doing is that they gave in by accepting the government of the Muslims, but without accepting their religion. This is something that they can do. According to the verses of the Holy Quran, people of the book, Christians, Jews, if the Muslims are fighting against them, they are either going to accept Islam or they're going to accept to be living under the Islamic state, under the Islamic empire, government, but they're going to be paying taxes, as of course everybody does. Muslimin pay taxes in a Muslim government because they have to pay khums, and there's zakat. So there's taxes that believers are going to be paying. These non-Muslims that won't be paying khums or zakat, they have another tax that they pay, and they accept to live under the Islamic empire and the government of the Muslims by accepting to abide by the rules in public and paying the taxes. When the taxes came from that region, the first year after the conquest of Egypt, when they gave in to the terms of the Muslims, 12 million gold coins this time. Dinar, not dirham. The difference between dinar and dirham is dinar is gold and dirham is silver. The first year, that means the population, because it's the taxes that they would pay in that way, would be based on how many people you have in your family. So the taxes were 12 million gold coins. It was 2 dinars for each person. That tells you the population there at that time was 6 million. 6 million Egyptians accepted the terms, and 12 million gold coins came to Medina. This would be something that would be recurring. Annually, this would be taking effect. So the lands were adding on, the taxes that people would have to pay, the khums possibly, maybe that was collected, the zakat definitely that was collected from the Muslims themselves. All this money started pouring in, all right? Based on what we explained, that the khulafa, what they started to do is that they started changing the way the Holy Prophet dealt with things. Initially, it didn't sound or look like they were doing anything terribly wrong. Why? For a couple of reasons. All right, this is important. It's very important. When they started doing those very wrong things that would show the results, the negative results, in years to come, in decades to come, people didn't, or it didn't strike people as this being terribly wrong for two reasons. Why? Number one, a good number of believers didn't live at the time of the Prophet. They were unaware. They didn't have much knowledge about things. So if the Khalifa says, this is how we're going to do it, their assumption is that this is based on what? This is based on the teachings that the Holy Prophet has given. If he's the Khalifa of the Holy Prophet, if he's the successor to the Holy Prophet, and he's saying this is how we're going to do it, the people that never saw the Holy Prophet, they didn't know how he dealt with circumstances like this, then they would automatically assume that this is something that the Holy Prophet would do. But beyond that, not only people that didn't see the Prophet, there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, a companion of his by the name of Sulaym ibn Qais al-Hilali. Sulaym ibn Qais al-Hilali. He's the one that has a book. Some have translated it and called it in Farsi, The Secrets of Alu Muhammad. Sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Some of the stories that we get about what happened after the demise of the Holy Prophet are found in this book. He's a very respected companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He's a tabi'i. In other words, he didn't see the Holy Prophet. And he was someone that sided with the Imam. And it says that this book became such a concern that he was chased after in order to prevent this book from circulating. And he had to give this book over to someone whom he didn't even have much trust for, but he had no other choice. So anyhow, there's an account in Al-Kafi that Shaykh Al-Kulayni, through the chain of narrators that he has, he quotes this person asking Amir al-Mu'mineen. He says, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I find it a bit difficult when I come to you and to people like Salman, Abu Dhar, and Miqdad, you give me certain interpretations of the Holy Quran, you give me certain ahkam, you tell me that a certain ruling, a particular ruling in Islam is a certain way. But when I go to others, they give me a different picture. They tell me something different. So what's going on here? Is it just you, Salman, Abu Dhar, and Miqdad, you guys are telling the truth? Everybody else is lying? What's going on here? Amir al-Mu'mineen says, let me explain. It's a lengthy hadith. He basically, the gist of it is this. He says, no, it's not such that everybody's lying. But what happened was, this companion was there and he heard part of the message of the Holy Prophet. He didn't hear the second bit. The other companion only heard the second bit, didn't hear the first bit. Okay. They don't have the full package of Islam. They're not lying. There's a number of them that weren't lying. No, they really heard the Prophet say that. But we have something called naskh, abrogation. The rules changed. An instruction was there initially, then a different instruction was given. And it's a long story why that happened, but this is a fact, anyone studying that history. So the same thing is happening here. Companions of the Holy Prophet that were there with him, they didn't know exactly how Prophet did everything. This is one of the main reasons, one of the reasons why we say there's need for imamah is this. If the Holy Prophet would have left this world without someone with not only and simply having the knowledge that the Prophet gave to people through hearing what the Prophet said, through writing that down and keeping a written note of it and later on referring to it, if it was just an average person that would have that type of understanding, then this would definitely lead to the religion being changed even without the intentional alteration of religion. Because when you write something down and it's a complex matter, later on when you look at it, you're scratching your head trying to figure out what I wrote down there. Okay. Students know this sometimes. I've gone through this experience. If you're dealing with a complicated matter, even you take a note on it, later on when you want to refer to it, you're not sure you're going to get the right understanding of that. Okay, there needs to be someone that not only has heard the Holy Prophet the way you and I would, and an average person would, you need to have someone that is ma'soom and is guided by the divine through immaterial and spiritual ways. You need to have that. People didn't know. They didn't know. So what happened? All the wealth is coming in. All the wealth is coming in. The decisions that were made about the distribution of this, we said it wasn't the way the Holy Prophet intended it, and it ended up moving forward. Why? We said for two reasons. One of them was people didn't know, and we finished explaining why people didn't know. course, there's more to say about that, but I think we got a gist of that. The second reason was it sounded religiously sound and good. There are certain things that religiously sound good. Okay. For example, if you say you respect the progeny of the Holy Prophet, some people have said this, all right? Now, I don't want to raise a controversy here, believe me, okay? I really don't. But we have a lot of hadith on this about Sayyid and non-Sayyid marriage. You guys have a lot of culture in that. I don't want to touch that, okay? But is it such that a Sayyid has to marry a Sayyid, otherwise there'll be loads of religious problems? Is it a must or not? Religiously, I don't want to touch the cultural issue. Religiously, it's not a must, okay? But if you say, no, the progeny of the Holy Prophet, it has to remain pure. People listen to that like, oh my God, there's something there that sounds pretty accurate. There are certain things that religiously sound good. What did the second Khalifa do in this regard? All that wealth is coming in. The distribution of that wealth that's coming in is extremely important. The verse of the Holy Quran in Surah Al-Hashr, where they received fay', okay, ma afa Allah, what God gave as fay', returning to the Holy Prophet, giving this wealth to him, it was supposed to be given to the Holy Prophet, not because this was supposed to become his as the ruler, and just like every system in the world, the ruling class is the wealthiest. That's not how Islam's picture is. Don't get that wrong. When it says it goes to the Prophet, it doesn't mean that he keeps it in his pocket and people are dying and he just saves it there. Or out of generosity, he gives a bit of that pity cash to somebody just because he feels for them or that it's good to be generous. No, this money that the Holy Prophet is supposed to control, the verse of the Quran explains, it's so that this does not start becoming or circulating amongst the wealthy of you and create an upper class. Create a class that is above the lower class and start to create more of a distance between them in terms of the wealth and the amount they own. That's why it's supposed to go like that. But what did the Khalifa do? He said, this is how it sounds religiously okay. He said, okay, write down the names of everybody, keep records, which is something that started then, keeping records of the different people that you have. But then when he started to say how he wanted to distribute this, he said, put the name of the Holy Prophet and then start by those, with those individuals that are closest to the Holy Prophet, and then list the other ones after that. So based on that, what is the picture? You have the family of the Holy Prophet. Then you have believers that are not part of the family of the Holy Prophet, but they were those that were with the Holy Prophet during his time. They sacrificed for Islam. People that took part in the Battle of Badr, which was a very difficult battle, according to the Holy Quran, that battle, those who took part in it are not the same as those who didn't. So they were respected more. So those who participated in that battle, those who participated in other battles, they were listed in that way. And then the wealth was being distributed on a regular basis amongst them in this way. The ranks are like that. So the family of the Prophet gets more. Right? People who fought in battles get more. Then the regular person, the newcomer to Islam, they get a little bit down at the bottom, whatever remains. Thousands are going to the wives of the Holy Prophet. Thousands are going to the family of the Holy Prophet. Thousands are going to the companions that fought in battles. Now when you hear that, sounds pretty good, especially since it's the family of the Holy Prophet that takes precedence over everybody else, right? Well, actually, that's not the case. If you have these people, yes, they have a level of connection with the Holy Prophet, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran said, that's not a basis for you to have privileges in society. Inna akramakum indallah atqakum. Your rank based on the degree of your taqwa, and that's in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wealth is being distributed to help everybody out. It's not supposed to create an upper class. When you regularly start injecting money in the pockets of certain people that don't even need it, they're fully capable of working, they are making money, they don't need it, but you constantly giving to them, this becomes a problem. It becomes a very serious problem. Now, when you look at the way this Khalifa differentiated between people and how much he gave to each of them and what the differences were, and you compare it to the third Khalifa, it's incomparable, because the third Khalifa, the idea of privileges, people having privileges, that became a lot worse during his time, and the amount of privileges they had were incomparable. You have his relatives, the relatives of the third Khalifa, having authority and control in certain regions like Kufa, and that governor of that region under Uthman, he basically has easy access to whatever amount he needs to spend. It wasn't like that during the time of the second Khalifa. I want to remind you of the gradual process, and this is the scary thing. We're talking and mentioning all of these details so that we see the gradual digression, the gradual move away from the teachings of Islam. During the time of the third Khalifa, this governor, for example, this is only an example, although legally, even based on what the Khalifa, the third Khalifa had said, the governor of Kufa had a certain portion he could use on different expenses and the expenditure that he had. He couldn't just use whatever wealth, Iraq being very wealthy, him being the governor of Kufa, the wealthiest part of Iraq, he couldn't just use it any way he wanted. The person who was responsible for the treasury of Kufa was Ibn Mas'ud. He was a companion of the Holy Prophet. He had his issues, but overall he was a pious person. He supported Amir al-Mu'mineen. He didn't like injustice. He was in control of it. So when the governor wanted loans, he would give him loans. Even that was wrong, of course, but he would give him loans. But the governor of Kufa kept taking loans and spending extravagance on his drinking parties and different dance parties and so on and so forth that you've heard. One day he went to the masjid and he prayed the Fajr prayer 4 rak'ah. And he said, if you want, I can even add more rak'ahs to that. I'm feeling really good this morning. Okay. He was spending money on that. From where? From the pocket of the mu'mineen, of the believers. Government money was being taken but not repaid. And then when Ibn Mas'ud started to threaten him, hey, I'm not going to give you anymore, it was Ibn Mas'ud that was removed. All right. So you see, up to this point, what we've tried to explain is that from this second Khalifa onward, all this wealth coming in started to get distributed in a way where a certain class of the wealthy, of the affluent, the upper class started to form. At the time of the third Khalifa, it got a lot worse. You had people struggling, not having funds on the streets of Kufa, and you had people that had so much gold when they passed away that when they wanted to do the math of how many gold coins go to each person, instead of doing that, they realized it takes too long to count the coins. They just gathered all the coins, melted them down, turned them into gold bricks, and distributed it in that way. That's how much gold these people had. You had the upper class like that, and you had people that didn't have enough to support their families on the streets of Kufa and even in Medina. Even in Medina. Now, the last point that I'd like to mention, and I hope I'm able to do it tonight, because I don't want to extend this too long, and I'm really trying to summarize this to get to the points. Remember, we started with this. We said, according to Amir al-Mu'mineen, the problem of the people that leads to them not following the truth. When Amir al-Mu'mineen tells them this is the truth, Amir al-Mu'mineen, who is ma'a al-haq wal-haqqu ma'a, when he tells them and guides them with what the truth is, they don't want to take it and they want to go the other direction. to the extent that they stop following him, they stop going to battle with him, they stop supporting him, and then some of them even turn into enemies, and one of those comes and assassinates the Imam in Kufa. The reason for that, he said, ittiba'ul hawa, following the desires. Following the desires. What we try to build up the understanding of is to show how those small, it seems small at the beginning, who cares, just the leadership changes, who cares, what's the difference between Ali and this other individual? What difference does it make? Why is it that it's wrong to have that type of attitude that the second Khalifa had and be rigid and harsh? Sometimes it sounds like, no, actually you need to be like that in order to rule properly. If Ali had that, he would have been able, that's one of the problems that they raised with Amir al-Mu'mineen's rule. They said he's got humor. He's got a sense of humor. A leader shouldn't have that. He should be strong, he should be tough. Gradually it shows itself. What happened? That upper class that was being supported by the government, brothers and sisters, these are the people, if you remember the way the distribution went, it was the family of the Holy Prophet, the real good believers that fought in the battles of Badr and Hunayn, in the battles of Khaybar and Ahzab, these people whose incentive was to get closer to Allah, what they had in mind was the Akhirah. Now, after their pockets starting to get filled with money, these people start to have more desire of the dunya. And instead of them being symbols of simplicity, symbols of piety, symbols of worship, symbols of carelessness towards the dunya, now they are symbols of very wealthy people with huge pieces of land, large homes. When you have the influential people in a community start moving towards the dunya, everybody's desire becomes the dunya. That's why it becomes a social problem, see? It's now not only the richy rich that are striving to have more of the dunya, and that becomes their goal in mind. Everybody starts looking for the dunya. They want to have a piece of this. People that were in Karbala weren't people that were very wealthy, but this culture caused them to want to take what belonged to the daughters of the Holy Prophet. When their leaders are moving towards the dunya, they're competing on who has how much cash, who is able to give more dowry to their daughter-in-laws. You have millions of gold coins. I was thinking, I don't know how it is in the Indo-Pak culture. In the Iranian culture, it's unfortunately amongst a certain group of people, it's becoming such that the dowries are increasingly becoming more and more. Thousands of gold coins. Sometimes we joke around and say, because some say, you know, five, you have the panjtan, five gold coins. Others say, well, no, you got 14 ma'sumin, so 14 of them. Others say 110 verses of the Holy Quran. 110. So what about 124,000 prophets? Okay. There you go. It's getting very expensive, right? It gets very expensive to get your daughter married. These become very serious social problems. I thought it's bad today. When I looked at that history, the sons of some of these companions of the Holy Prophet that used to avoid the glamour of the dunya, used to sleep on bare floors, used to not care about money, put their lives on the line for Islam, they would give millions of gold coins as dowries to their daughter-in-laws. When that becomes culture, everybody moves in that direction. It takes time, but then now, you talk about God, whether it's the poor person on the street or the very wealthy, that's not something that's going to drive them. That's not something that's going to drive people. When Amir al-Mu'mineen said, "What happened to you? For the sake of God, let's go fight." Like, what are you talking about, for the sake of God? Yeah, that's good for in the masjid, but we were getting a lot of gains from the non-Muslims. Now we're going and fighting Muawiyah. There's no gain in that, because there's Muslims. When the Battle of Jamal happened, you know what they wanted to do? These people on the camp of Amir al-Mu'mineen, they're like, okay, we just want a battle. So let's do what we always do. What is that? Take all the cash that they have. Amir al-Mu'mineen said, no, sorry, that doesn't happen here. These guys are Muslims. These guys are Muslims. Whatever they brought to the battlefield, if you find a sword there or whatever, you can take that. But whatever they have at home remains there. You don't touch it. It's not yours. You can't take it. So you see, there's nothing in return. It's only for the hereafter. It's only for God. Sorry, Ali. This is what happens. Gradually, a society goes from wanting shahada, giving money to go for shahada. They would pay for their own horses and camels to go to the battlefield to get killed for the sake of Allah. At the time of the Prophet, gradually, 25 years, they go to the battle, they want cash, they want money, they want gold. When they don't get it, it's not good. Ittiba'ul hawa becomes a social disease gradually. When you don't follow those parameters, we said the halal and haram, the wajib, the way God has said to do things, the first step in the wrong direction, like, oh, it doesn't really make much of a difference. But in the long run, in 10 years, in 20 years, you will see, no, that very small mistake there is going to take you in the wrong direction. If you don't correct it. Ittiba'ul hawa as individuals, brothers and sisters, is going to lead us in that direction. If we do that, it's going to lead our families. I may be engaged in prayer and fast, but if what I'm really catering to is the dunya, you see your children are going to be one step ahead of you. And even the prayer you're engaged in, they're not too serious about that. And their progeny is not even going to be having or looking or even carrying maybe the name of a Muslim. Gradually happens. You just ask. Recite a salawat, please, and move forward. Allah. One of the serious things that Amir al-Mu'mineen tried to do with the people of his time that had developed into an upper class and a lower class, but everybody, similar to the situation we have here in the world today, in most of the world today, and it's being spearheaded by the West, and we live in it. And that's why this is a very important discussion, brothers and sisters. Especially in America, the capitalist system, whether you are down bottom and you have nothing, or you're way at the top, what drives you is the dunya. Everything is about the dunya. How much you can gain, in what ways. The person's way down here, they still haven't figured out how they can get up there. If they could have, they would have. Direction, the direction of the society is that direction. Amir al-Mu'mineen tried to change that. He tried to change that. And that's why, because the social change has gone on, this culture has developed over time, and everybody's now used to it, changing it is going to take time, and people are not going to like it. Over the course of 4 years and 9 months, most of the talks of Amir al-Mu'mineen are telling people how worthless the dunya is. Why? Because this culture has developed. He wants to change them back. Bring them back. What Amir al-Mu'mineen does is what? He wakes up after Fajr, he gives the talk to people, and he reminds them of the worships that used to happen during the time of the Holy Prophet, that people used to stay up all night long, worship, pray, prostrate, and still fear Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he would cry and he would get the people to cry. He would himself dress the way you have heard. Everybody has heard the way Amir al-Mu'mineen dressed. Part of the reason why he dressed in that way is because he wanted to make it clear that the direction that the culture has taken is wrong. No, you shouldn't be looking. It shouldn't be that the person who has control and authority and is leading has got to have the most amount of wealth and has got to have the biggest house and has got to have the biggest number of slaves and slave girls and gold and wealth and so on and so forth. It doesn't work like that. He dressed in the way he did. He had bread and salt on these last nights of his life because he wanted to show that that's not how you live your life. Ittiba'ul hawa has to be corrected. And I, Amir al-Mu'mineen, as the leader of the Muslim Ummah, have got to take a few extra steps to show people that no, you're taking the wrong path. When his clothes would rip, he would sew it with his own hands. His shoes, similarly, very simple shoes. And he would do it in public. People would see, not to show off, but to show people that, look, your leader, the one that has, remember all the wealth that we were talking about, that's still pouring in. Amir al-Mu'mineen has all of that. It's all under his fingertips. And loads of people came and asked for it. His own brother Aqil comes and asks for it. Aqil is blind. You've heard the story. Amir al-Mu'mineen gets some of that hot coal, gets it close to his hand. He says, what are you trying to do? Burn me? And he said, what are you trying to do? You want to burn me? This is the fire of this dunya. If I give you one of those gold coins where God has said, no, I'm buying hellfire for myself. Money was borrowed from the treasury for Amir al-Mu'mineen's daughter by his son-in-law. Amir al-Mu'mineen seriously got onto him. Said, next time you do that, I'm going to cut your fingers off. That's theft. Be careful. This is serious business. Amir al-Mu'mineen would walk in the streets of Kufa in the middle of the night and distribute bread amongst the poor on top of the salary they would get. And he would give, he would also go out. It wasn't just that. He would feed them. He would go to their homes. He would go to the homes of the believers who'd lost their husbands and their fathers. And they needed help without them even knowing. It wasn't about showing off. This is what Islam teaches them. We read this 1400 years approximately later. And we're supposed to learn from this, brothers and sisters. This is how we're supposed to be. We're not supposed to be looking for recognition for good deeds, for helping out. He would go without being recognized, without being known. He would get the oven ready, play with the children, the orphans. And when the oven was ready and hot, he would put his face before the fire and said, Ali, feel the heat. Remember the heat of hellfire. And on these nights, these families are starting to realize who it was that was giving them the company. The poor people that were living on the outskirts of town, and they would have someone, a man, come to them at night and spend time with them, speak to them, hear them, help them out. they started to realize who this was. السلام عليك يا أمير المؤمنين السلام عليك يا أول مظلوم Let's take our hearts to Kufa, the house of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The city of Kufa feels very lonely. It's been a couple of nights that the poor and the less privileged have not seen the man that you was used to come and help them out, sit with them. It's been a couple of nights that the masjid in Kufa has not seen Ali worshipping them. It's been a few nights that the beautiful voice of Amir al-Mu'mineen reciting his munajat, maybe people hearing it and weeping, has not been heard in the masjid. Allahu alayka ya mazlum. Brothers and sisters, it is tonight, sometime in the middle of the night, that your beloved Imam leaves this world. But brothers and sisters, there's a similarity between what happened tonight in Kufa and what happened in Medina years ago. It is interesting to see that just like the daughter of the Holy Prophet that was supposed to be buried in the middle of the night, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib was also supposed to be buried in the middle of the night. Only his children, his close companions had come. But there was a difference there between what happened in Medina and what happened in Kufa. The reason why Amir al-Mu'mineen was buried at night. There were many differences between these incidents. One difference is that in Medina, when the lady Fatima al-Zahra was buried in the middle of the night, it was in order for her to show her dissatisfaction with what was happening, with Amir al-Mu'mineen's right being taken. That's why they had the little children of the lady Fatima al-Zahra try to cry and weep with a low voice, quietly. But the reason why the body of Amir al-Mu'mineen was supposed to be buried in the middle of the night, brothers and sisters, the mazlumiyyah of Amir al-Mu'mineen, no wonder Ali is called Awwalu Mazloom. Brothers and sisters, with all the great things he did for the people of his time, to try to guide them in numerous ways and help them out, the reason why Amir al-Mu'mineen was buried at night was the fear of what they were going to do with the body of Ali after his burial. Did you know that the grave of Amir al-Mu'mineen was hidden for decades? Why? Because there were fears that the Khawarij were going to dig the body of Amir al-Mu'mineen up. disrespect his body. But brothers and sisters, I would like to say that these moments tonight, when Amirul Mu'mineen is leaving this world, although for his children tonight is a very sad night, for Amirul Mu'mineen, this is not a very sad night. This is not a very painful night. You know, when was a painful night for Amirul Mu'mineen? The pains that Amirul Mu'mineen dealt with were not in Kufa. They were back in Medina. The day Amirul Mu'mineen had to observe his wife coming home from the masjid, but when she enters the house, Amirul Mu'mineen sees that the lady Fatima al-Zahra is not able to find her way. Imam al-Mujtaba has to take her hand and guide her. Maybe something happened in the streets of Medina. Maybe the mal'oon raised his hand on the beloved lady Fatima al-Zahra. You know, when the pain of Amirul Mu'mineen is, it's the day they came to his house to take him to pledge allegiance. And the one who protected him was the daughter of the Holy Prophet. She said, "I will not allow you in." They said, "If you don't open the door, we'll burn the house down." She said, "Although I am in this house," they said, "Yes, even though you, the daughter of the Prophet, are in the house." The door was set on fire. Ruhi lakil fida. Amirul Mu'mineen, I'm not sure what he was doing, if he's aware of this happening, but all I can say is that a call is heard. Ya fiddatu khudini, fidda, help me and hold me. I'm not sure if Amirul Mu'mineen truly saw what happened there. But you know, when he actually found out was when he was washing the body of the lady Fatima al-Zahra. In the midst of the washing of the body, although he had said to the children, "Cry and weep quietly," they saw Amirul Mu'mineen as he's washing the body over the clothes. When he reached the shoulder, he couldn't take it any longer. He stepped back from the body and began to cry. "Fatima, you didn't tell me what they did to your shoulder." ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون.